personality, cash money, and the slot right here.
300 Quaker, probably in the slot, I'm looking to do.
They steal the store, they turn it to cash.
Okay, I'm on the northbound actor. Just right at the light.
Look, I mean, Carl, what the hell can they do? And I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Hello, folks. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, there's a little bit of blowout on that mic, but we'll figure that out. Folks, we have a very special show for you this afternoon or tonight, whenever, I guess it depends on when you listen to this. We never know when you listen to this.
Yeah, if you're going to bed right now and you're listening to the podcast because it puts you to sleep, I don't know why you're doing that, because this one is going to keep you up all night long.
I think it will. We have a very interesting show. We are doing an offsite, shall we say. You know, back in my police days, when we had a surveillance out of an apartment or something, we called it an offsite. And so we are in the offsite today and in another city. And we have a very special guest. If you remember, we did a show about a hijacking of an airplane out of St. Louis, Missouri.
A two-part episode, actually.
It was. What was it? What did we call that?
I thought it was just hijacking. Because we were talking about D.B. Cooper.
Right.
And these hijackings back in, what was 1971 when D.B. Cooper did? And then a series of other ones that occurred in 72.
Right, and they were all with people who parachuted out of the plane. Now, you don't hear of that anymore. You only hear of people hijacking planes to blow them up and hurt people. Back in those days, they were hijacking planes to get money as a crime or make a political statement. Political statement wasn't to kill people. It was to go to Cuba. We did that show, and we talked about a man by the name of Martin McNally, who hijacked a plane out of St. Louis in 1972. We put that up, and I got an email about 2 weeks ago, a week ago, and it was Mr. Martin McNally, and he told me that I got a few things wrong. So we have emailed back and forth, and we are now at Mr. McNally's home in an undisclosed location, and he is out of the penitentiary after two life sentences, I believe. He would like to straighten us out.
Well, first off, when he contacted us, one of the first things he said was that it was hilarious.
Yeah, that's true. You know, we tried to be funny.
Which I think that was, we weren't necessarily, I don't know that we intentionally go about trying to be funny with what we're doing. It's just the humor of the situation sometimes comes out, and certainly having the man who did it say that. And then he listened to the second episode, and an hour later he sent a second email or comment. Right. Said that was funny as well, but that we did get some of the facts wrong.
Yeah, that's kind of the ultimate compliment, isn't it, Aaron?
I think so. I don't know, facts wrong or
facts
hilarious?
Wrong. That's both the ultimate compliment. Anyhow.
He is here with us today.
Yeah, so Mac, I'm going to call you Mac, and he's given me permission to do that. Mac, would you say hello to everybody?
Hello, everybody.
Well, we really are happy to be here. This is very exciting for us because we usually just tell one side of the story. And as I told you, sometimes you know, I never let the facts get in the way of a good story. Well, you're going to straighten us out on the facts. And as we were listening to this on the way down here, we had to drive out of town, folks. But we're not going to say where again. We were listening to this, and I realized we probably did get some things wrong. But I'd like to go back and ask Mike a question. When did this first come into your head, and how did that come into your head? Was it from D.B. Cooper, who was real famous at that time, but all over the news?
Well, D.B. Cooper was definitely had something to do with this. Thanksgiving 1971, he pulled his stunt up in the northwest, Seattle and Oregon. I took note of that. January, first or second week of January, I was in a car with one of my crime partners, and we were going to see a mutual friend. And it was about 10 o'clock in the morning. We were in his new Cadillac as we were about a couple blocks from his gas station. It came on the news, one of the DJs in Detroit said that talked about skyjackings, and he said the way to stop these skyjackings is to give everybody who buys a ticket $500,000. There won't be any more skyjacking. It'll stop it. At that point there, I laughed like hell, and I said, damn, that's one way to make some money. Just get on a plane, give them a letter, an extortion letter, and bail out and go on your way. But that's when the first idea came into my head.
Interesting. Now, you said one of your crime partners. Would you mind going back just a little bit in your past before this? You were raised in a large Irish Catholic family, sounds like, in the suburb of Detroit. Seven brothers and sisters, right? I think your dad was quoted, said that you had always gotten a little bit of trouble. So you were kind of the black sheep of the family.
I was definitely the black sheep of the family. Five sisters and two brothers. They all have university degrees, and I was the only one that bummed out of school. I quit school on the first day of the 11th grade when I was told by the Catholic nun that because I failed 10th grade religion, I would have to take that entire class over. I said, yeah, sure. I walked out of the room and flipped the finger and went down and got on the phone and called the Navy recruiter. And I told him I'm 17 and I'd like to join the Navy. He said, okay, come on down and see us. I walked home about a mile and a half to our house. My mom said, why are you here? Why are you back? And I said, Mom, I just quit school. And she said, what? I said, Mom, I just quit school. The nun said I had to take the religion class over again because I failed 10th grade. I'm not going to do that.
Now, wait, so what year was that? You were 17?
I was 17. That would be 1961.
So that means you were born in?
1944. I'm 72 years old now.
61, you left school at 17. Somebody must have had to sign for you to be able to get into the Navy.
My parents had to sign. Yes, they did. And my dad was very disturbed about this. He said, you're going to regret this, and you can go back to school and go to a different school and so forth. And I says, Dad, I'm through with it. I'm going in the Navy. My older brother was in the Navy, and I said, I'm going to go in the Navy too. And he said, you'll regret this. And I said, well, I'll have to live with it. I never regretted it.
Interesting. So why'd you go to, like, Great Lakes, to the basic
camp there? Yes, I went to Great Lakes in Illinois, the boot camp there. Did okay. Left boot camp in January, and from there I went to, and I was the only one that went to this squadron that I went to in Washington State, Patrol Squadron 2. And I was with them for close to 3 years.
Okay. So is that where you first met D.B. Cooper in Washington State? No, I'm just kidding you.
I never met D.B. Cooper.
We joined the Navy, not the Air Force.
Oh, so. Yeah. I know there's some connection with you and D.B. Cooper. We'll find it.
Yeah.
Well, the FBI never could find, but we're going to find it.
No, I joined the Navy, and I went in. My brother was in aviation. So I went into Navy aviation, too.
Okay. So did you have, what was a particular job that you did when you
were there? I was an electrician, aviation electrician. Did very well, enjoyed it. I was a crew member on one of the patrol squadron planes. I have about 1,500 hours of flight time, and it was a lot of fun, very dangerous, and a couple of close calls. And it's a hell of an experience.
Interesting. So you were in there about 3 years?
I was in there about 3 years, yes.
And then you were discharged out.
And you had an honorable discharge.
General honorable. But I got out on December the 15th of 1964.
So you came back to Detroit area. Was it
yes.
Detroit? Was it Wyandotte, Michigan?
Wyandotte, Michigan, Wyandotte, yes. Michigan,
which is a suburb, I guess.
Yes, it is a suburb of Detroit. It's south of Detroit. Nice small town. We drove my car. I had a 1957 Chevrolet, my brother and I, and we picked up a hitchhiker along the way, and we drove him to Minnesota. We asked the guy for some money for gas, and he says, no, I'm not going to give you any money for gas. But, yeah, he was a bum. We dropped him off in Minnesota, and it took about 3 days. My vehicle never ran the same again. I don't know what happened to him.
And you went home back to Michigan?
Yes.
Now, as an electrician in the Navy, then, I mean, they taught you a skill. Did it translate then outside when you left the Navy?
No, it could have, but it didn't. I didn't. I could have gone to the airport there in Detroit and probably applied for a job with the airlines, but I didn't do that.
So it sounded like you maybe fell into a life of crime right away. Is that?
Well, actually, in less than 60 days, I was pulling some stupid stunts in Michigan, in the area of my hometown.
And that was at that point you must have been like 21 years old.
Yeah, I was 21. I was pulling some really stupid stunts. I really hesitate to go into them, but dumb arm robberies, get $100, $75, $150. And when I was looking in the paper and I noticed that armed robbery in Michigan carried a life sentence, I got out of that. Stopped pulling those stupid stunts.
We are, you are doing some crime. Now, statute of limitations is up on all those little armed robberies.
Yes, of course.
So we won't worry about them.
No, I'm just embarrassed to talk about it.
I understand.
You came out of the Navy, it would have been like 65?
64, December.
64. And I mean, is there something you wanted to do? Or you're like, okay, I've done the Navy, I'm going to go home.
I really didn't know what I was going to do.
You didn't know what you wanted to do.
My dad wanted me to go to work for him.
Where did he work?
He owned a shoe store in Allen Park, Michigan. He bought the place in 1944, the year I was born. And he wanted me to go to work for him, and I just didn't want to do that.
Sounds kind of boring for a guy like you. You more like a guy that wants a life of action, it appears to me.
Well, I had action, too much partying, drinking, yeah. And carrying on, and girls, and all these other things that youngsters do.
There you go.
And that was just in the Navy?
That was out of the Navy.
That was out of the Navy.
Yes. I had a lot of that in the Navy too, of course.
So you're back in the Detroit area, and you're doing some small crimes, and I understand that you're not very proud of that, but you know, you were a young kid, and we all do. I did some stupid things when I was young, not quite to that extent, but I know we got drunk, went out, and shot up a bunch of mailboxes one night. it's some various vandalism kind of things like that's what most young men do.
Yeah.
Then you had this idea that, you know, here's how I can make a lot of money. It's just like it's such a graduation, such a reach from, you know, robbing a corner convenience store maybe to going on the plane. But tell us a little about your planning for this.
Well, before I go into that, let me regress here and say that I got a job at the steel plant, worked in the steel plant. And then after that, I worked there for about 8 months, wound up getting fired. And then I went to work for Dana Corporation, and I was I had a good job there. I was an inspector and a welder. Then I left them. I hooked up with, I got married. My wife's friend was married to a fellow that ran a Clark station, Clark gas station.
Oh, sure, I remember Clark.
He trusted me, and he clued me into how he was beating Clark Oil out of a lot of money. I guess he got about 60 grand out of him, 60 or 70 grand out of him before they snapped that they were being beat. And they finally kicked him out of the station.
Mm-hmm.
He put me into a station. He got me into a Clark station. And I was only in it for about 90 days, and they kicked me out because they knew the scams that were going down there.
He told you the scams, and then you went as an employee and kind of ran some of the same stuff.
I ran the Clark station, and I got him for about under $10,000 before they snapped and kicked me out.
What were you doing, like selling those cigarettes and keeping
money? No. This was they would deliver gas on consignment. You'd run the pumps back.
No.
turn the meters back, and then keep the money that
you
ran down and send them about $200 or $300 for a weekend's selling gas.
So they didn't even know. It's like we are not selling as much gas as we used to.
They don't really
know why at first. Okay,
my supervisor snapped immediately.
Yeah.
So this guy that was my partner in this.
That's your partner in crime.
Yeah, he introduced me to credit cards. running credit cards. So I got turned on to fraudulent credit cards. That expanded. We had Montgomery Ward, Sears, Kmart, all these different credit cards, and getting thousands of dollars in products, and then turning the products into cash. This all came to an end in 1971, pretty much. He had gotten into a Shell gas station, Five and Beach Shell, on Five Mile Road in Beach Daily in Redford Township, Redford City. But he was in there for 1 year, and he ran. We both ran credit cards through the business, Shell cards that were stolen cards. We got about 10 or 15 thousand bucks from Shell. They snapped to what was going down, but they really couldn't do anything. They tried to, but they couldn't do anything. And they kicked him out of that station in March 1st of 1972. He had been in there since March 1st of 1971. Now, in I left his business in January, probably about the first week of January.
Of 71.
Of 1971. We were still connected, looking for things to do. And that's when I heard that radio DJ in Silly. Detroit talk about
the D.B. Cooper case.
Yeah, the skyjackings that were going down.
Do you remember what station that was on?
Oh, God, I couldn't even tell you.
Or who the DJ was?
I couldn't even tell you. It happened about 10 o'clock in the morning. It came on one of the stations. But
was it one of those memories that you can just, like, visualize and put yourself right back there now?
Oh, immediately.
Like, you were sitting in the car, and the DJ starts talking about the D.B. Cooper.
This is something like the same as when Kennedy got killed.
Yeah, exactly.
You know where you were at.
Yeah, I've got a couple like that.
And
that's
when
amazing.
When this memory comes in, it's so stark, it's the pivotal point that changed my life for the worst.
It was.
It totally destroyed me, because I followed up on this. I really wasn't a sophisticated criminal.
And you remembered that, and then you were sitting there in the car listening to that with your friend who you'd been doing other credit card scams with, and you said, that's it?
Yeah, that would work. Get on a plane, give him a note, and order some parachutes, and get all the money, however much money you want. They're gonna up it and bail out. I thought that was the thing to do, but I wasn't factoring in all these other people knowing. And when the government comes in and offers the rewards, they're gonna rat you out and snitch you out, and you're dead before you even start.
That's for sure. So let's Mac, tell us a little bit about your planning then, and how did you talk to a lot of people about this, that you were gonna do this?
Yes.
Probably under the influence of alcohol, if you were a partier at the time, more than likely. But how did you start making your plans?
I had a dude that I used to, he was unemployed, and he was a pool hustler, and we'd go to bars. I'd back him up playing pool, $10-$20 a game. I got to talking to him, and I told him, I'm thinking about skyjacking a plane, getting some money. Thinking about getting a lot of money, and I'd like you to be my partner on this. And if we do this thing, what we'll do is we'll get two packages of $500,000 apiece. We'll strap them up to us, and we'll both bail out. And when we hit the ground, we can watch each other's back and live good forever. And he said, yeah, I'll do that. Within a month, he changed his mind. And I think he was talking to his wife about this, too. And he just got cold feet. And he told me, he says, he can't do it. He can't be bailing out of a plane and going into Timbuktu, no telling where you're at. So I said, okay, Walt. I said, if that's the case, I'll still work with you, and I'll give you $25,000 if you'll be my chauffeur, my driver, wherever I need to go. He says, okay, I'll do that. I promised him $500,000.
So this was Walter Petlikowski.
Walter Petlikowski from Riverview, Michigan.
So he had been a pool hustler with you.
He was a pool hustler. That's where he made a lot of money. And we used to go to bars probably every day at night. And so that was it with him. Yeah.
Okay. So then you got a chauffeur.
And this was in like the spring of 2001.
This was in February.
February.
Late January, early February of 1972.
72, after yes. the D.B. Cooper, which was in and, Thanksgiving of 71.
Yes, I told Walt, I said, I need to get a weapon. I need to get a decent weapon. He said, well, I got a rifle. And I said, I'd like to see it. So he had a long rifle. I looked at this thing, and I says, I think this will work. I forget the model of the rifle, but when we went to court, the FBI agent said there were 13 of these rifles unaccounted for nationwide. 13 of them. He said that they were being pulled off the market because they could be easily machined and automatic. Well, what I did with this rifle, I cut off 12 inches of the barrel. I took off the stock. There were two screws on the stock. I took those off. With the barrel off and the stock off, it had a long clip. I think it had 25 or 30 cartridges in that clip. 45 caliber, big barrel. It looked just like a grease gun. And I told Walt, I said, this is going to work. So
it really wasn't a machine gun. That's one fact I got.
No,
wrong.
It was not a machine gun.
Okay.
And they said it was a machine gun. And it was a single shot rifle. It was cut down to look like a machine gun. Yes. And I told him on the plane, it's a machine gun.
Yeah.
To scare him.
Yeah.
But it had a long clip that extended down and
yes, very long
45
clip.
Calibers, large caliber rifle or you
big
know,
old
gun.
I told the stewardesses, I said, you tell the pilot and you tell the FBI on the ground that this weapon has a big hole in the barrel and it's got a very long clip and it's short and it's a grease gun.
Okay.
That's what I told them.
you also, they claimed that you had grenades, which
yes.
was pretty important that because I was talking about grenades, nobody's going to rush a grenade. So why did you do that?
Yes, they said it. I said it was a grenade. It wasn't like a military grenade. It was just a smoke bomb. But I told them I had one of them, and I said, this is a grenade. And I said, I also got a pistol here. And I showed him my pistol. I figured on all of this stuff, just making the threat is enough to have them kick out with the money. It did the trick.
Yeah,
they did. They gave the money and parachutes and everything else.
So going back, where'd you get the smoke grenade, you remember?
From Walt.
From Walt. Walt had this?
Yeah,
and the pistol as well?
The pistol, no. I got the pistol from somebody else. I forget who it was. I believe it was a 25 caliber Beretta, small pistol, and we'll get into that because that's the weapon that I had when I bailed out of the plane. I had it in my back pocket, and we'll get into this about the chief of police. And
yeah, okay. Yeah.
Beretta and the
well, that, we're kind of carry the storyline along here. Did they? you were married at this time though, still.
Let me see.
You said you had gotten married.
In 72, I had separated from my wife.
Okay.
I was separated from my wife, and she was living with her mother, and I was living alone, and I had a house in Wyandotte, a very nice house that I had bought, but yeah, I was living alone, not working at the time.
Not working, doing just with your friend, pool hustling.
Not working at the time, and I really wasn't doing much because. I wasn't paying my mortgage on the house. I was behind on my house, and we'll get into this, but they sent me a notice of foreclosure.
Mm-hmm.
That pretty much set the stage for taking care of this.
Yeah, really. Now, one more thing, and then we're going to go to a break. The clothes, and did you have a wig, and the clothes that you, how did you, the article I read said you had really loud, garish clothes that apparently you had your other clothes on underneath, I think, and a wig. So tell me about that part of the planning, then we'll go to break here.
Yes, I had a wig. I think I paid about $30 for that wig, and that was really stupid because I should have just made something to cover my head when I came out of that that bathroom in the plane. I shouldn't have paid $30 for a damn wig. But the clothes that I had some good-looking clothes. They were off-yellow trousers. I had a new pair of shoes, brown quarter-inch shoes. I looked like a businessman. Getting on the plane, I had an attaché case, and that's what was in the gun was in the
gun. Was an attaché
Was it an attaché case?
Well, they said it was a trombone case.
No.
That's another fact I got wrong. Sorry about that, folks.
Yeah, they got that wrong right from Jump Street. Somebody said it was
a trombone case,
but no, it was an attaché case. I think the people that put that out wanted the public to think that you need a big thing, a big carry case to bring weapons on board.
Yeah.
And it was just a small attaché case with these weapons and stuff. At one point, I had two clips, fully loaded clips, strapped back to back, and I put them in the attaché case. But this thing was so heavy, I said, man, I can't be doing that, because one of a handle could fall off and this thing could hit the floor and open up and I'd be dead in the water. But I only used one clip.
Now, there was no security at all. We just walked up, bought a ticket.
Security was terrible. We'll get into that. Security was terrible.
Walk on the plane with a handgun, an attaché case with a sawed-off 45 caliber rifle, and a smoke grenade, which could, if you went to a metal detector today, would have set the thing off, I'm sure.
Right.
Well, we'll get into that, but on the timeline, when I went to St. Louis, because I made several trips to St. Louis.
Oh, in advance?
Yeah.
How did you decide on St. Louis?
Do you want to pause here and we'll take a quick break?
Let's pause and get a cup of coffee and we'll be back.
Folks, and on the next episode of this exciting true crime story, we will go into the actual boarding the plane, how that happened and what happened when we were on the plane. Aaron, I think I'll give a little public service announcement here, and we'll.
Did you bring your notes for first call?
First call. I've got that baby memorized.
You do have that memorized
now. If you have a friend, relative, or if you yourself have a problem with drugs or alcohol or any compulsive behavior, any addiction problems, make your first call to First Call. Area code 816-361-5900. And if you're from out of town or you don't really want to call in there, it's a 24-hour hotline. Isn't that right, Aaron?
That's right.
And you can go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org, or if you're out of town, just go to their website and you can email them and they will direct you to some facility or some resource like that in your own hometown.
And if you enjoy the podcast, remember to subscribe to the iTunes and give us a review. If you enjoy this episode, let us know. And Gary will send you a autographed copy of his DVD, Gangland Wire.
That's correct. Or I will send you a password to get to the chapter of my true crime book that I'm working on. Or we can talk about what you might want. Anything digital, for sure.
Another book that he's working on is much like this episode, is words from the mouths of the men that did it.
Exactly. You can listen to Nick Savella tell you how to skim and scam from casinos.
Or how they checked to make sure they weren't getting scammed.
Exactly.
By people skimming from them as they were skimming from the casinos in Vegas.
That's right where I am right now, in the moratorium on the skimming from Las Vegas, as they're sitting around talking about it. All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, folks.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Check them out at oddomaticmusic.com and on Twitter at oddomaticmusic.